Hey, let's jump into the text. Luke 12 is our text here this morning. Luke chapter 12. Continuing to look in this area of stewardship and specifically at the teachings of Jesus, our Savior. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me. Right? This old children's rhyme was meant to, I think, encourage children who are getting picked on the playground, and maybe to try to curb any type of retaliation. But, of course, the rhyme itself is patently false. For many of us, broken bones have healed long ago, but the names, the words, still echo to this day, right? They're still open wounds. You remember things that people have said to you, maybe even your parents said to you, that was very hurtful. Words are powerful for good or for evil. Boston Globe reported this week that Pentucket Workshop Preschool in Georgetown, Massachusetts, outlawed the term best friends. It was thought to be hurtful to those who might feel excluded. Perhaps a bit over the top, but good for us to think about, isn't it? Just to think about the impact of our words. Christians of all people, we ought to be at the front in terms of civil discourse, in terms of making sure that our speech is seasoned with grace, right? I mean, that ought to be something we're all about. We don't want to give unnecessary offense. As messengers of the gospel, we want to do everything we can to be winsome in our communication. So it's a good thing. And many of these groups that are establishing anti-bullying policies, these are good ambitions, and they reflect the importance of words. Jesus spoke very clearly to his own followers here in Matthew chapter 5 about a warning about violent speech. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, Raca, is answerable to the court. And anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. And then I got some extra commentary. That's not part of the verse there. Sorry about that. But there's this great statement by Jesus, right? That to say, you fool, to issue that type of a declaration to a person is a very serious thing indeed. So we ought to be very concerned and recognize the importance of words. And so it surprises us a bit as we look to Luke chapter 12 to find a man called a fool or an idiot in this text. And it would perhaps surprise us even more that God is the one who is issuing this declaration, who's calling this name. Matter of fact, it's the only recorded parable where God plays an overt role. We are actually given the speech of God in the parable. And perhaps that's because God is the only one who is able to make such proclamations, right? It is not for us to call one another fool or to use that kind of a speech, but God is able to make right judgments. It is his prerogative to make such declarations. The fact remains that some people are fools. The speech ought to, the words there ought to kind of shake us. I gave you that title this morning. Are you an idiot? I mean, this text ought to have some bite to it. It ought to leave us. Matter of fact, the way it plays out, it kind of leaves it unresolved. We don't know how they responded, and we're made to wonder, you know, what. Am I a fool? I mean, what? How does this text apply to me? So, no one's going to call you a fool today, but the text does lead us to ask, am I a fool? The term fool refers to someone who is without sense. They're ignorant or unwise. can refer to someone who is lacking mental capacity through no fault of their own, but it is used here to describe a person who has potential for understanding, but who has refused counsel and paid no attention to warnings. And the Proverbs give several categories of unwise people. One of those is a fool. So this is the type of terminology that is surfacing in this text, and I want us to feel the weight of it here this morning. Two parts to the text. The first part is narrative. It's a conversation that's going on, and then the second part of the text is a parable. So we'll consider them in turn, and then we'll take a few minutes to just take note or think about the nature of a foolish person. And try to think about what really marks a fool and be able to do some honest self-evaluation here this morning. So the narrative portion is a request for justice. A request for justice. Let's look at Luke 12, verse 13. Someone in the crowd said to him, to Jesus, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Man, who made me a judge or arbiter over you?" And he said to them, "Take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." So a man came to Jesus with a grievance. We get a little sense of this individual by the fact that he interrupts Jesus. He interjects, and there's a teaching opportunity going on here, and this man just blurts out his own issues. He's very much self-focused. And he doesn't simply make a request for help. "Jesus, would you help me with this?" No, he issues Jesus an order. He tells Jesus what to do. "Make my brother cooperate and give me my portion of the inheritance." We would generally think here probably of a division of money, but in the ancient world, most likely it was a division of land that he was asking for. Generally speaking, it would be customary for brothers to live together, to inherit the father's estate, as it were, the family farm, and to be able to live peaceably. Psalm 133 talks about this. "It is good for brothers to dwell together in unity." And this seems to actually be a reference to inheritance-type laws. But this one brother was saying, "No, I want my share. I want to be able to sell and divide the property and take what I have coming to me." And according to the rabbis, this was, this type of a request was to be granted. It wasn't ideal, but it was to be recognized and granted. So it seems, although we're not given a lot of detail, the general sense of the passage is that this man had a legal point. Interesting to me to see this man's perception, or consider this man's perception of Jesus, that Jesus, he wanted to use Jesus to get something. I couldn't help but think about that in the day and age in which we live. I believe there's a great many people who, that's how they view Jesus. Jesus is there to make my life easier. Jesus is there to be the genie in the bottle. And when my life goes wrong, "God, why could you allow this to happen to me?" That's why I became a Christian, so that I could experience prosperity. And we're reminded in this text in a very vivid way that that's not what Jesus has come to do. He doesn't come to make our lives easier. He came to die for our sins. He didn't come to fix our apparent problems, the things that we think are our problems. He came to resolve our true problem, which is our sin. And so there's a bit of a wake-up call just to think of how we view Jesus. Jesus refuses to arbitrate in this situation. He has a rather curt response to this man. He's unwilling to be a referee in this petty domestic dispute. If you're a parent, you know what it is to have to be the referee. And Jesus was unwilling to to go there. We're not exactly sure why he didn't. It could be in part that he had a clear sense of his mission. He did have a clear sense of his mission, right? He was not here to establish a political kingdom. He wasn't here to set up a court system or a physical government. But I believe also here, Jesus had a clear understanding of the situation. He understood that this really wasn't a financial issue, but a heart issue. It wasn't an issue of injustice or hardship. It was an issue of greed. And so he identifies it for what it is. He drives at the root issue here. Jesus knew that this man would not be satisfied even if he received his portion of the inheritance. He had an insatiable desire for more. Jesus used this opportunity to warn his followers about the insidious nature of greed. I find this to be an interesting sort of turn in the text. Jesus having, and the context fills this in for us a little bit. Jesus was there with a great crowd of people, we're told at the beginning of this chapter. But chapter 12, verse 2 says that he was speaking first to his disciples. Or I would take that to mean that he was speaking primarily to his disciples. So there's a group of onlookers. There's a bunch of fringe people that are gathered there. But Jesus is primarily having a teaching time with his disciples. So this man interrupts, issues his order to Jesus, and Jesus turns and addresses him very briefly. And then he turns to them. I think this being a reference to his disciples. He conveys the lesson here that he wants them to glean from this situation. This man presumably was marked by greed, but the point is that Jesus' followers were just as susceptible to greed themselves. This is not simply a tax for that unbelieving neighbor who earns a six-figure salary and has all the latest technological toys. This is a tax for us, followers of Jesus. And to me, notable that Jesus turns the conversation back to his followers, his disciples. This is for you. This is for me. We need to hear this today. So Jesus then goes to illustrate in a very powerful way by means of a parable, calling it the parable of the man with the bumper crop, right? Rich man had an unusually large crop and had to make a decision regarding the surplus. Nothing here that would indicate any wrongdoing. He earned this crop through legal means, nothing underhanded. We're not told that his motivations as a farmer were somehow in question. Nothing about prosperity being a bad thing. The very opposite. God prospered this man. God caused his land to produce plentifully. So this is good. So far, so good in the narrative. This is not a problem that this man was wealthy. See that the man had a role in his success. We can assume that he planted the crop and cared for the crop and harvested the crop. But at the end of the day, it was God who gave the increase, right? We can do all these other things, but it's God who ultimately gives us whatever we have. And that much is brought through even in the language of the text. The land produced a great crop. Here's the hinge point in the parable. This man made a decision to use the surplus to enhance his own comfort and pleasure. So this is the big question here that hangs in the balance. What will he do with the surplus? And the assessment is that he proved to be a fool because he made preparations for this brief life but failed to plan for used his resources to plan for the next 20 years, for his retirement years, but he failed to plan for eternity. He was short-sighted, right? That's the assessment of the text. So in the few minutes we have here remaining, I want to suggest to you some foolish ways of thinking. I want to try to unpack what's going on in this scenario so that we can help think about whether we are fools, whether we in any way would fall under the description and the judgment of this text. So here's one foolish way of thinking that I can maintain possessions and not be affected by them. Notice here, verse 15, and he said to them, take care and be on your guard against all covetousness. The idea being that greed and covetousness is subtle and insidious and gradual. It has a way of creeping into our lives. The things that we possess have a way of possessing us, right? And he even talks here about different translations bring it across differently. Take care and be on your guard against all covetousness or every form or every kind of covetousness. Greed wears different masks. It comes in different disguises. It shows up in different ways. There's greed for money, but we can have insatiable desire for any number of different things. And so Jesus is just calling them to be on alert. And I would contend to you that it doesn't matter how much money you have. You might be wealthy, and you might be a generous giver. You might be a top giver, a consistent giver, but be given still to greed. You might not have very much at all, thinking this is a non-issue. This is a rich person's issue. And yet, be consumed with the desire to have. So a foolish way of thinking would be to think that I can maintain possessions and not be affected by them. To think that this is not an issue for me. If you think it's not an issue for you, then you're a fool. I didn't call you a fool. I just was creating a theoretical example, all right? How has greed infiltrated your life? What steps are you taking to guard against the relentless desire for more? What boundaries have you put in place to protect yourself? Another foolish way of thinking, I will be satisfied if I have just a little bit more. Notice what Jesus says there in the initial dialogue, the initial narrative, take care and be on your guard. This is verse 15. Take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. Life is more than accumulating possessions. An abundant life will never be achieved through simply an accumulation of stuff. We live in a materialistic culture. We're trained to think that way. If I just had a little bit more. Some of you might know this little chart. This is Maslow's hierarchy of needs. It's secular psychological theory. Take it or leave it. I'm not putting it forward to you as any sort of authoritative source, but it's interesting to think about. Maslow said to achieve joy and satisfaction and fulfillment, there's certain needs that have to be met. And of course, he starts off with physiological needs, food and shelter, air, right? I have to have these things if I'm to survive and in any way flourish. And then that second level, moving from bottom to top, safety needs. Need to have, you know, some measure of personal security, employment, that sort of thing. And you might say that wealth or would help provide those bottom two levels in the hierarchy. But there's a lot more to life, isn't there? And that's Jesus' point, that life is a lot more than just food and clothing and shelter. And we need to address those upper areas of life if we're going to achieve fulfillment and joy and satisfaction in life. Do you foster a spirit of contentment? Do you make it a practice to thank God for what he has given you? Or do you always feel like you're being cheated, that somehow you haven't gotten enough? This tendency to find my significance, to find my joy in possessions. It's a foolish way of thinking. Another foolish way of thinking, that it is wise to accumulate as much wealth as possible. Certainly commendable to save. We have the example of the ant. Go to the ant, you sluggard, you lazy person. Consider its ways and be wise. It has no commander, no overseer or ruler, yet it gathers, it stores its provisions in summer and gathers its food at harvest. So we would agree and understand that saving is a good thing. The ant saves. We ought to save. This man in the text had barns, didn't he? He had barns within which to put his crops. The idea being that those barns were enough. If he filled his barns, they would carry him through until the next harvest. But he wanted to build additional barns so that he could save up for more than just one season. He wanted to save up for many years, right? And that saving turned into hoarding. And so this mindset of just continuing to accumulate is what became the problem. Snodgrass, in his commentary, notes the connections here with our own culture. Parables like this strike a tender nerve, especially when we admit to ourselves, as we must, that we want to be like the rich fool. The message of this parable is as antithetical to our thinking as any Jesus told. I know of no more difficult topic to apply personally or to the lives of modern Western Christians. Our primary pursuits are our own security and pleasure, both, we think, achieved by possessions. And we face different dynamics in our day, don't we? We're not on an agricultural calendar, so we're not thinking about just the bringing in the crops, enough crops to get me through till the next harvest. Our economy works differently than that. And certainly how we think about retirement. In that day and age, you would just work and until you couldn't work anymore, and your children would take care of you. You have an amen in the house? We have notions now where parents are expected to care for their adult children. But no, it's the other way around, right? So those dynamics kind of shift a little bit in our culture. And yet, we have to recognize at some level the difference between reasonable saving and hoarding. We see what was driving this man, don't we? He wanted to amass wealth so that he would not have to work. And so again, we have to wrestle with that. That the goal is not just accumulation. I think sometimes even in Christian circles, we've come to think of stewardship. Good Christian stewardship is saving as much as possible and spending as little as possible. I have news for you, friends. That is not what Jesus taught. Burying your resources in the ground is not a good thing in Jesus' economy. Right? We are to allocate those resources. So just the accumulation of wealth, while it seems very wise to us in our culture, if taken to an extreme, is a foolish way of thinking. Resources I possess are mine to use solely for my own benefit and pleasure. There's another foolish way of thinking. It is true that God provides resources for us for our own needs, but God provides resources to us for more than simply our own needs, does he not? Ephesians 4:28, let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor, doing honest work with his own hands, so that he may have something to share with anyone in need. For God's purpose is not just that we take care of ourselves, but that we're in a position to be able to share with others. Ambrose, 5th century, he was St. Augustine's pastor, and Ambrose suggested that this man in the parable did have barns within which to put his extra grain. Those barns were the mouths of the poor. There was a place for that grain to go. But this man, of course, was only thinking of himself. My crops, my barns, my grain, my goods. But we get a fuller view here at the end of the parable where we're told that your life is required of you, right? God says to him, fool, this night your soul is required. This is language of loan, that this man's life was not his own. His life was on loan. He was not just caring for his own possessions, but his possessions had been entrusted to him, and now God was calling him to account for the use of his life, the use of his goods. So it's a foolish way of thinking to think that my resources are mine to do with solely as I please. The question is not what do I do with my earnings, but rather what do I do with what God has entrusted to me. I sometimes think that when my kids are out of college and I get a higher paying job, that I will then be generous. I tell my kids that a lot. Their little resources from babysitting or jobs around the house, whatever it might be, that if you're not generous now, you're not going to be generous when you have a lot, right? The model is not to simply save up and provide for myself, but God's providing us resources to be able to be a blessing to others. We're going to stop there. Our time is gone this morning, and some of you really like to fill in all the blanks, and so I'm just going to make sure I leave one unfilled today. Just for you OCD types. But I'm just praying. I know God's been working in my heart. Sherry and I, as we've walked through this process, I know in the hearts of our leaders to stretch us. And I'm praying that God, even by his word today, this stretches our thinking. I don't know about you. I don't want to be a fool. I don't want to be so distorted in my thinking that God has to issue this type of a proclamation over me. So words are powerful. Here we have this powerful word in this text. It's a bit of an uncomfortable word, fool. But we're made to ask, am I a fool? Am I viewing my life and my resources in the ways that I should? Am I making true plans for eternity or just for my life now?